Welcome to The Climate Fix. My name is Asim. On this show, we shine a spotlight on nonprofits, academics, corporations, startups, anyone working on a solution to the climate problem. In this episode, recorded on the 3rd of April 2020, I spoke with Harriet Kingaby. She's the co-chair of the Conscious Advertising Network, a voluntary coalition of organizations from across the advertising ecosystem on a mission to ensure the ethics catches up with the technology of modern advertising. She's also a Mozilla Fellow, studying the unintended consequences of AI-enhanced advertising alongside the organization Consumers International. Harriet has worked as a brand purpose strategist at various communications agencies in London, including Media Bounty, and as a co-founder of Borico, where she helped brands big and small to make positive changes around climate change and social issues. I met Harriet at a climateaction.tech London meetup, where she was part of a panel discussion on women impact makers in climate. Now, I've actually worked in the advertising industry, so a lot of what she said resonated with me. Our conversation reminded me of just how complex and nuanced the advertising world is. I now understand that through that complexity, advertising is often unknowingly funding climate denialism, and that by cutting off the funding, you remove some of the incentives to create climate denial content. Let's dive straight in. So hi, Harriet. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Asim. Great to be here.
Awesome. What is the climate problem that you are solving?
So the climate problem that I'm solving is looking at the funding model for climate misinformation. So we all kind of get our news from various different sources online, and how credible or otherwise those sources are can really vary, because the internet is this fantastic platform for free speech and for getting those ideas out there. But unfortunately, there are economic gains to be had by posting fake news and misinformation around, kind of prescient and, day-to-day topics. And climate misinformation, sadly, is one of those. And I work a lot with advertisers to try and understand how we can stop advertising appearing next to climate misinformation and therefore inadvertently funding it.
Oh, that's really interesting. So why is it worth solving this problem? How big of an issue is climate misinformation?
Well, COP26 is coming up, and sadly it's just been postponed until next year. But it's basically going to be one of the most, most important climate kind of conventions since the Paris Agreement in 2015. And so we feel like this is going to be a bit of a focal point for, everybody, essentially, if you're campaigning for action on climate change, but also those that would rather see no action happen at all. And, they come from various different sources. It's some people who just kind of want to make some money through advertising on the internet. You've got more organized structures of people who, for various reasons, be that monetary, be that political, would rather that we didn't solve the problem. The organization that I kind of co-chair was formed in 2018. And at that time, we kind of soft launched at the UN Global Compact on Migration in Marrakesh. And at that time, there was a huge targeted misinformation campaign that suggested that if that UN compact was passed, that actually it would become illegal to criticize immigration, which was complete rubbish. But it was featured heavily on various different platforms, went up through the recommendation algorithms of particular platforms. It was even featured in kind of tabloid newspapers in the UK. It eventually caused the collapse of the Belgian government. And it meant that lots of countries from Chile through to the US through to Poland backed out of signing this compact. So we know just what an impact this kind of targeted misinformation campaigns can have on really, really important global agreements. And unfortunately, if you look at those articles, if you look at those videos, they will be inadvertently funded by advertising, often by brands that actually would much rather see, that have great diversity and inclusion policies, would much rather see, action around, safe, safe migration and refugees, and the same thing for you know, kind of having science-based climate targets. So what we want to make sure is that advertising isn't part of this cycle and isn't kind of inadvertently funding this kind of stuff.
So that's really interesting. So if there is misinformation out there on a website in some format, it's getting traffic, and therefore the algorithms have put adverts on that website, and therefore those advertisers are funding the misinformation in the first place. And you actually mentioned something earlier on, I didn't even think about it from that perspective, of people just want to make money. And so perhaps they just know that this is clickbait, it gets a lot of traffic, and then this funding advertising. Very interesting. So how is the Conscious Advertising Network, CAN, how is that helping to solve this?
So CAN, we are a voluntary coalition of around 80 organisations. We're on a mission to make sure the ethics catches up with the technology of modern advertising. And the way that we've done that is by writing 6 manifestos, which look at various areas where we feel like advertising can do better. So they're everything from children's welfare through to fake news, hate speech, consent, ad fraud, and diversity and inclusion. And what we've done is we've signposted to initiatives that are already out there that can help advertisers, you know, kind of really look at their supply chain in a more detailed way. And we've also kind of filled in the gaps. So, for example, in the hate speech manifesto, we were having lots of discussions around what constituted hate speech and people feeling very concerned about stymieing free speech. And so what we've done is we've pointed people to kind of UN guidance on what constitutes hate speech, and, you know, to help people really understand where the red lines are. So we've been doing that we launched in June last year. We're looking at getting advertisers to sign up and put this in all requests for proposals that go out. So we just changed the way that you know, the advertising supply chain is kind of monitored, and we change what advertisers are asking of their agencies and other vendors to do. And, you know, we've had a great response over the last year. We've kind of grown an awful lot. And our fake news manifesto in particular looks at 3 things that advertisers can do to tackle this kind of misinformation. So it's things like treating premium publishers who they trust differently to you know, kind of random websites on the open web, for example. And it also means things like thinking about the metrics and the way that they measure the success of particular campaigns, because we know that really just focusing on, you know, kind of engagement with your advertising isn't a holistic measure of success and can lead to some of these, you know, these failures that we've seen.
Could you take me and the rest of the audience on a little bit of a journey regarding the different players in the advertising industry? I have done a little bit of work in there in the past, and I know it can be quite a complex, intricate field. So, yeah, just take us on a journey about the different players involved.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's incredibly complicated. It's something that I've gone on a big learning curve around in the last 2 years. So basically, what used to happen with advertising is it used to be kind of directly bought. So if you wanted to put your brand up on a billboard somewhere or on a television network, then you could actually just phone up the billboard company or the television network, or, you know, and say to them, right, we want to buy this many units, etc. And what's happened with the digitization of advertising is actually, it's not that advertising necessarily gets directly bought on a platform anymore. Actually, what happens is it follows you around the internet. So I'm going to see really different adverts to you. You're going to see really different adverts to me based on things like our browsing history, the things we like on social media, you know, kind of all that kind of stuff. And it sounds like a really simple switch, but it's unbelievably complicated. So when I sign onto a website, there's this whole auction that happens in like no time at all that determines the advert that I'm going to see. And it's why sometimes you get, you know, kind of slower pages loading, because you've got this kind of whole process going on in the background. And so your advertisers, like talked about, they're the ones who are giving money to this kind of online, the technology providers who are kind of essentially kind of providing all the information and hosting this online auction. And then on the other end, you've got the publishers who receive some money from that whole transaction as well. So it's a bit like an eBay auction happening every time I go on a new website.
So let's say a website owner is a publisher, then an advertiser is just saying, I want these adverts put somewhere, but they don't necessarily have a clear line of sight regarding where that advert's going to be placed. Because just from an advertiser perspective, I'm just going into a black box of an auction and it's just going to come out the other side wherever it's going to go. Does that sound about right?
Yes. And what's happening is advertisers are going, I want to reach, kind of women in their mid-30s who, you know, kind of live in particular areas and like, I don't know, walking their dogs. And so therefore, if someone like me who likes all of those things is on a web, you know, kind of goes to a website, then there's going to be, kind of that auction kind of based on that information, because someone's going to go, we've got one here. And then that's going to happen.
There's going to be a battle amongst all the advertisers who all want to target people like you. And then the person willing to pay the highest price is going to get to show the advert to you.
I think it's the second highest price, so that you don't get ridiculous. You know, you could bid ridiculous amounts of money and grab everything. But that's the process behind it.
So what you've done is you basically created a set of manifestos that are guide that are signposted with other things, perhaps by the UN, for instance, the fake news one, and you're getting advertisers to sign up to this? Or who along the chain are you wanting to sign up to these?
So our main focus is advertisers, because it's their brand essentially, and it's their, it's their money that's kind of getting poured into this system. And I've worked for agencies, and when our client says they want something, we will do our best to give it to them. So although we've got a really broad mix of people signed up, it's the advertisers who have the kind of power within that system. We've also got agencies signed up, because often we've had people say, hey, we want to sign up, or we want to try this out. But that means all of our agencies have to change their behavior. So then their agencies will sign up and start implementing our manifestos in the work that they do. We've also got the tech vendors. So the online auction system we mentioned earlier on, the people involved with that, they can sign up and look at ways that they can make sure that the process by which they're buying and selling that space is more ethical. And then we don't necessarily have publishers necessarily, but we do talk to publishers quite a lot, because obviously they're really important. The really important bit, I think, is that we've got lots of civil society members. So people like Show Racism the Red Card, Tell Mama, and those kind of organisations are signed up as well, because what we're finding is we talk a lot in the industry about brand safety, but issues with advertising are actually affecting humans. So we talk to our groups about human safety, because, for example, if hate speech is being funded, by advertising, and it's creating a market for hate speech, which the UN has identified, then you've got organisations like Tell Mama, having even harder a time getting their message across and doing their work than they would do before. And so we feel it's really, really important to bring civil society to the table, so we've got that human and diverse input in a way that we wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, as you're speaking, it makes complete sense to me. I don't know why a single advertiser would ever want to have their advert displayed on any kind of climate misinformation or definitely a hate speech or any of these things. The brand damage is huge just from a screenshot of that. So yeah. So what stage is the Conscious Advertising Network at? Kind of how many people? It's a non-profit, isn't it? Describe the actual organization to me.
Yeah, totally. So we are, we've got around 80 members who are public, and then there's loads of people in who are working up to going public, because it's quite a meaty thing to sign up to. And we've been around for about 2.5 years, but we officially launched in June last year. And in that time, we've kind of grown a lot. We've reworked a couple of our manifestos because these issues are changing all the time. So we've just reworked our fake news manifesto to represent things like the rising climate denial that we've seen and climate misinformation. And we've reworked, we review and rework the manifestos periodically with, experts in the field. So our fake news and misinformation manifesto has just been put, you know, kind of reviewed by various of our members who work in those areas. Diversity and inclusion was recently updated by Creative Equals, and Ali Hanan did that alongside advertising, because there's a whole new areas around media buying that we hadn't included in there. So we just keep these things going, and the idea is to at least be as far ahead of mapping out this achievable leadership position as faithfully as we can.
Excellent. So are there any concrete examples of successes that you can point to?
We've seen when, for example, HP a couple of years ago, they decided that they wanted more representation and they wanted their adverts to be more inclusive and diverse. And they managed to get their whole agency roster to change their hiring strategies, to change the way that they kind of assessed the successes of campaigns, and HP saw a big uptick in its kind of brand affinity and things like that. So we know that when, you know, the advertising industry puts its mind to things, it can do things and it can make change really creatively and quickly. And that's the kind of stuff that we're trying to facilitate.
Brilliant. And I think you mentioned earlier on also, and it's something I think for our listeners, we're actually recording this on the 3rd of April 2020, so in the midst of the corona pandemic. And you mentioned earlier on about COVID misinformation. And just today, I managed to find myself going down the rabbit hole of Twitter, of 5G coronavirus. Some sort of misinformation has gone around that 5G causes coronavirus or something along those lines. And I even saw a video today about somebody harassing people in laying internet fiber optic cable, which is not even 5G. Saying that that's going to cause coronavirus. So I think there seems to be some misinformation happening out there as well. Like, what have you noticed on this space? And you mentioned earlier on that it's something you've seen an uptick in.
Oh, definitely. Coronavirus misinformation is really, really dangerous. And it's, in some cases, it's coming from, you know, in inverted commas, trusted news sources. We've seen links, things linking 5G and coronavirus on news sources that I think should know better, to be honest with you. And Alan Rusbridger actually tweeted this morning that this is a rehearsal for some of the climate change misinformation we're going to see. And we've got a few problems here. So there's been a big conversation this week and last week about advertisers blocking coronavirus news on trusted websites. So I think it was the Washington Post was running its front page with no adverts on it because advertisers had been adding coronavirus to their block lists, and the technology that they'd used to try and avoid content that's unsavory was actually blocking hard news. So there's been a big debate around that, and advertisers, I think, you know, they can't, there should be, you know, kind of hard, we need hard news in a time like this. We need great reporting and quality journalism, and I think there's a huge responsibility by advertisers to make sure that that's funded, which we'd love to see them lean into a bit more. And, you know, you were talking about this kind of the 5G. I saw that video as well, where there's a woman harassing these people laying cable. Like, that's one of the many hoaxes that's originated online. And there's got to be better filtering of that stuff, better ability to kind of application of technology so that we recognize when these words appear together, the sentiment of articles, and try and avoid kind of advertising there. And that's some of the stuff that we see when, you know, kind of advertising on the open web. It's obviously more difficult on social media because, you know, it's difficult to regulate what you're seen against. But again, there's a big coordinated effort here that's needed between advertisers, between the platforms themselves who are hosting this stuff, and, you know, better strategies and more open communication and more accountability around, you know, kind of fixing this problem. So Avaaz, for example, did a big piece of research last year that looked at how climate misinformation flowed through YouTube. And what they found was really disturbing. They found that the fake news was and the misinformation was actually recommended more heavily by the recommendation algorithms because it's salacious and because it gets reactions from people. And unfortunately, that's rewarded. So there is, as well as the advertisers, thinking more cleverly about how they're spending their money, there's also these, you know, there's also needs to be action from the platforms. And you have seen around coronavirus, Twitter and YouTube behaving slightly more like publishers by kind of alerting people to trusted information. So there's a whole load of action being taken. It's just that we want to make sure that we're learning lessons from what's happening right now.
Yes, exactly. And I'm glad there are things happening in this space. It sounds like from a technical perspective as well, because even though you've signed a manifesto, it sounds like there are actually technical difficulties, such as kind of like a hard keyword search of COVID is going to find the good articles and the bad articles. Can you speak for a little bit about some of the technical challenges and solutions to solving this?
I can certainly try. I'm not a technical person, but I'm, kind of aware of the broad brush things. So if you're blocking by keywords, it can be a very blunt kind of instrument. So if you're blocking coronavirus, you're blocking everything, the bad stuff and the good stuff. And lots of organisations have been encouraged or have created these really long block lists, which aren't necessarily helpful. It means that lots of the web isn't being funded in the way it could be. And I think there's also an issue with the application of the technology. So I think it can be more subtle and more nuanced. Certainly I've spoken to providers that use things like AI. There's a brilliant report by Check into fake news and how that travels through the internet, if anyone's interested in it. Some great stats around just how much businesses are losing and how much democracy is being destabilized by fake news and misinformation online there. But if you use providers that are able to offer some more nuance, then I think that's, that is a good way. And I think there's a strategic role here as well around when do we deploy these technologies. So if we're deploying these technologies to do, to buy advertising on really trusted news sources, then, do we really need to be blocking things on the Washington Post? I mean, maybe if you're an airline company and you want to avoid the word crash, but not for all buys. So I think there is a slightly more nuanced strategy behind the way that media can be bought and sold that would help to kind of solve some of these issues as well. And that's what we're advocating for in the manifesto, that organisations think a bit more, with a bit more nuance about the relationships that they have with these publishers and the technologies they deploy.
I see. So on one level, it's getting more information regarding where your advert is going to be placed, which I suppose if you're a publisher and you're going to spend money anyway, if you're choosing not to see that information right now, it doesn't necessarily mean you can't get that information. So getting that information, it sounds like, I get that from what you described, the nuance, get the nuance of where your advert is going to get published, and then be intelligent regarding where you put the efforts to check more thoroughly, because yeah, as you say, like Wall Street Journal is not the worst publication in the world.
Exactly. And there's also technological fixes which can help with things like advertisers not knowing where their advertising is going. There are technologies which will track that, track the transactions and track the publishers, the way the advert's appearing. And they're really useful in stopping things like fraud, because fraud is the second biggest funder of organised crime behind the drugs trade. It runs to billions as well, because we spent $330 billion last year on digital advertising. And a significant amount of that is being lost to fraud. So these technological fixes, they can be applied and they can be deployed. We just need to embed the use of them.
Yeah. So there's money to be made or saved. A lot of money to be made or saved. So there are deep financial incentives to make this work, make this a success.
If anyone's interested in that in more detail, there's a woman called Nandini Jami, who is the co-founder of Sleeping Giants, and her newsletter Branded is brilliant for breaking down some of these problems into really like understandable bite-size comments. So I'd really recommend anyone that's interested in that to sign up to Branded as well.
Yeah. And I think just this conversation with you now is reminding me again of how complex this industry is, and inside all that complexity, that's where a lot of evil, can survive. It takes some time to unpack. So yeah, I'll definitely like to get that plus a number of the other things that you've mentioned. We'll get them in the show notes for myself as well and for other people to read later on. So how does Conscious Advertising Network scale? How do you get from where you are right now to perhaps the maximum potential that you could achieve?
So we see ourselves as a temporary intervention. Like, we don't want to be around as the Conscious Advertising Network in, you know, kind of 5 years' time. We think that, you know, our goal is to get as many FTSE 100 companies signed up as we can in the UK, and then, you know, think about if this needs to go wider. And essentially what we really need is, we need advertisers, we need the people with money to sign up and say, hey, we're going to give this a try. Because when you sign up to the Conscious Advertising Network, you're not saying I'm perfect in these six areas. What you're saying is, I'm committing to trying to improve the way that we work in these six areas. And it's essentially, if we can do that, if we can get enough advertisers signed up, then we can change the way that this supply chain is conducted, and we can fix some of these problems, or at least go some way to fixing some of these problems, because as you said, some of them are super complex. And we can not only fund a more healthy internet, but we can we can also create advertising that's more effective and that reaches people in a more meaningful way. So I feel like it's just a big win all round, but we need people to take that leap of faith and say, we're going to sign up and support. And it's worth mentioning again that this is a voluntary initiative as well. Up until now, myself, my co-chair Jake, the steering committee, we've all done this in our spare time. And so there's not a kind of cost to it all. And so we just feel like we want as many kind of big advertisers to sign up as possible, give it a go. And, you know, we feel like that's going to go some way at least to fixing the problem.
And so what are some of the risks then? Like, what would stop you from reaching that goal?
So I think it's quite a prospect to say to a marketing department, here are six ways that actually you're affecting, you know, you're affecting the internet and potentially society. That's a change in the way that we often talk about these things. So we used to, you know, when we work in advertising, you're used to kind of talking about, well, actually, we didn't meet this target, or it looks like we might have annoyed people away from, you know, kind of engaging with our adverts. Worth noting that global ad blocking is up at around 41%. I think it's in the UK, it's around 41%.
Wow.
And the ad contrarians called it the biggest consumer boycott of all time. So, you know, we're used to trying to work out how to annoy people less and get people in the right moments to get the results we want. We're not used to thinking about, well, actually, this is having human rights impacts. This is funding climate misinformation and this could be hurting our brands. So I think the risk is that we don't embrace that, and we don't see that by just acknowledging that and taking some simple steps, we can make a difference. It's not a threat. It's not a, advertising is bad. It's not. It funds the internet. It funds the great things that we enjoy. It funds quality journalism and all that stuff. And it creates and embeds relationships with brands that we really enjoy having around. But unless we just step up and say, okay, we've got some things wrong so far, but we can put them right, then I feel like there's the biggest risk there.
Yeah, I hadn't realized ad blocking was that pervasive. I do admit I do use an ad blocker as well myself. But then again, there are also the ad blockers, they do let certain ad platforms through. I have adverts on my website which come through an ethical advertising platform which are allowed through the ad blocker. And that's quite interesting as well, that targeted ad blocking is a way of yourself choosing not to fund certain services and certain things you don't want to fund.
But it also cuts some funding to things you might want to fund as well. So it's that double-edged sword.
I would really like an ad blocker which would only allow adverts through for brands that I consider to be ethical. And then I'd allow them through on any platform I'm on. So there's an idea for a listener to create. That's something I'm perfectly happy with.
Definitely.
Yeah. So let's move on, if you don't mind. I'd love to talk a little bit about your background and what inspired you to launch Conscious Advertising Network in the first place?
Great. So, I mean, by background, I'm actually a sustainability communications person. I studied environmental science at university, and all I wanted to do was work on climate change. And I ended up slightly by accident working in writing about ad tech. And so you're sitting in a room talking about advertising with a sustainability training, and you're going, that doesn't seem right. Like, all this really contradicts what I know about creating great brands and all of that stuff. And so that was kind of what first led me to question things. And then I met at a conference, I met my co-chair, Jake, and we had the same kind of soapbox to thump on the day. And we kind of said, okay, well, we need to kind of keep talking about this. And so, you know, we essentially started going for coffees, and, you know, kind of it ended up with about 12 of us trying to meet. And so we ended up kind of starting this, starting the Conscious Advertising Network out of that. I was also involved in a kind of the Remain campaign as well, from a kind of an independent campaign angle. So I saw from
Brexit is just the noun, it's the noun, isn't it? So the Remain campaign was the campaign to remain within the EU. So you were part of that campaign.
I was. We're responsible for the Boris and Trump mural that appeared around the around the thing. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for that.
No one can ever unsee it. But so I, you know, kind of from that angle, I saw this kind of, we poured our heart and soul into it, made some great content. But what we didn't really think of is like the, you know, kind of the placement and the media side of things, and how that actually was being exploited by the other side. So I definitely went through a sharp learning curve in the aftermath of that. And it made me realise that actually these issues are so intertwined, and we have to play the internet, like, in a way, because the other side are. So that's how, you know, kind of we're going to change. We're going to kind of make sure that we kind of get the change that we want around things like climate change.
I think as you were speaking to me again, I was just reminded about how, you know, advertising is the thing that powers the internet. Like, I talk about electricity as well. Electricity is something that also powers everything that we see around us, but we don't see it. We don't understand it. It's an incredibly complex network, and it also is something that causes a lot of climate damage, but we don't see it. We're not involved with it. And advertising itself also is pervasive. It's everywhere. We need it. It supports our internet, and yet we don't know what's happening behind it, and we don't know how it perhaps has an impact on climate and so many other issues as well. And it's all these things that are hidden behind us through a thin veil and are incredibly complex, which is what stops people from digging too deep inside them. That's where all these problems and also solutions are as well, which is a thought I had just now. So also, one of the things I like to ask, and it's a challenge I have quite often, is that the climate space is hard. You've been in it for a long time, and it's something you've been wanting to do for a long time. For me, it can be quite tough at times. You're dealing with quite serious issues, and at the same time, you're dealing with quite big challenges, some of them seemingly insurmountable, and also people on both sides that are not supportive as they should be. What are some of the things that you do to stay motivated? Or what keeps you motivated, I should say?
What keeps me motivated? That's a really good question. I think there's a part of it is I just couldn't do anything else, which is just something within me. I think honestly, it's the little pieces of joy. So it's meeting really good people and having these great conversations with people where you're like, ah, like I hadn't thought of that, or this is a way of solving this problem that I just thought, you know, I would just never have thought of in a million years. And I think that's part of the wonderful thing about seeing the, you know, kind of tech industry join this space, is you hear of these amazing solutions or these ways of doing things, and you just think, gosh, that's incredible. So I think it's staying inspired is definitely a big one. And I think there's also a flip side of just occasionally really allowing myself to kind of go down the rabbit hole of seeing what those I really disagree with are doing. And going, okay, that's the other side. And when I say disagree with, I mean willfully. I feel like they willfully don't want that. You know, there's ulterior motives for them perhaps not wanting the change. So, and that gives me a little sprinkle of energy as well. And also, I think doing, you know, just like, you know, just looking after yourself a little bit. That's something you learn as you get older, isn't it? Like, just eat well and get some exercise and, you know, don't drink too much when you're feeling terrible, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've had to get very good at meditation, going for a run, looking after yourself. They're important as well. But I also do, one of the things, there's a lot of things I don't like about Twitter. And one of the things I do respect about it is you can go and see the other side. And that is something I do as well, just go down those rabbit holes of Twitter. And it is quite shocking, the conversations that you start seeing there. But also, more importantly, you do see it from their perspective and you see the conversations that are happening and what they actually really do believe in. And that helps you recognize that it's not. We like to tell ourselves these stories about evil people and villains and we're in this drama. And no, it's just people, and just some people are saying one thing and other people are saying other things. And yeah, that's the world.
That's what social media is encouraging us not to do. It's kind of almost encouraging us to polarize and say, yeah, we're right and you're wrong. And you're right. The joy of things like Twitter and also, but I think just daily life is talking to people about stuff you're passionate about and realizing that not everyone's as passionate about it. Not everyone wants the same stuff, but there's always stuff that we connect over. Some of my best friends don't in any way share the same political views as me, but we don't connect over that. We connect over different things. They might not care about climate change, but they do care about their family and they do care about, you know, the welfare of their kids. So it's just like, it's a good, it's a good thing to remember that we're all wonderfully different. And the only way that we will, sort out this thing that is climate change is by, you know, framing it in different ways, working with everyone, starting where they are, and really just, embracing the fact that we're all different. And that is great. But yes.
So just the last question. Is there something you've read recently, a person our listeners should follow, a thought you've had, or just an ask for our listeners that you want to share before you leave?
Definitely. So there was an article published yesterday in the Financial Times by Yuval Noah Harari. And in it, he makes the point about the world we want to see after coronavirus. And in it, he talks all about the potential, you know, the use of surveillance to really kind of to monitor people and how that can be a fantastic thing and how it can be and how we shouldn't actually think that it's either privacy or our health. And he unpicks that in a quite a beautiful way. And I know that we've been seeing all this stuff about COVIDiots and like, you know, kind of people can't be trusted online. And it picks apart why that can be a dangerous position for us to adopt when we've got governments that might sweep in and use that to their advantage. So if you want to read anything, I reckon that's the thing that brought me joy this morning.
Brilliant. I'll add that link to the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Harriet. This has been a really fascinating conversation. Amazing to hear all the things that Conscious Advertising Network is doing. And I'm really glad that you're focusing on this. It's a really important topic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
You've been listening to Asim Hussain on The Climate Fix. If you like what you heard, please hit subscribe on your favourite podcast application. It really does help. Information about this episode, including all the links that we mentioned, can be found on our website, theclimatefix.com. If you want to message me, you can find me on Twitter as Jawache, or you can email me at hello@theclimatefix.com. If you want each new episode neatly packaged together with the show notes and sent to your inbox weekly, then subscribe to our newsletter, which you can again find on theclimatefix.com. Till next time.